Who's the little one?
My daughter's girl, Hester.
How old?
3 weeks.
Does your daughter live here too?
Bertie pulled her cloth from the machine and shook her head slightly while she broke the thread with her teeth.
She goes to boarding school in Albuquerque.
I returned to exploring the living room. I was stunned to run across a small framed photo of two little Lloyds, identical, sitting astride very different horses. Behind them was a backdrop of dry hills and a brown water tank. Lloyd and Leander, 9 years old, looking as if they owned the world. Until I saw that picture, I hadn't really heard a word he'd told me about losing his brother. You can't know somebody, I thought, till you've followed him home. That evening, Inez's house filled with relatives for the feast. Cousins and uncles and aunts showed up, stamping the snow off their moccasins, bringing covered dishes and their own chairs. All the older women had their hair cut in the same style as Inez's, with short flaps over the ears and the heavy chignon in the back, and they wore silver necklaces and elaborate turquoise rings that shielded their knuckles. The teenage girls wore jeans and about everything else you'd expect on a teenage girl, except makeup. One of them nursed a baby at the table under her t-shirt. Lloyd and I shared one chair. Apparently, we were the official lovebirds of this fiesta. He spent a lot of time telling me what I was eating. There were, just to begin with, 5 different kinds of pozole, a hominy soup with duck or pork and chilies and coriander. Of the 20 or so different dishes, I recognized only lime jello cut into cubes. I gave up trying to classify things by species and just ate. To everyone's polite amusement, my favorite was the bread, which was cooked in enormous, nearly spherical loaves, 2 dozen at a time, in the adobe ovens outside. It had a hard brown crust and a heavenly steaming interior, and tasted like love. I ate half a loaf by myself, believing no one would notice. Later, in bed, Lloyd told me they were all calling me the bread girl. Our bed was small, but after 3 nights in the truck, it felt deliciously soft. I cuddled against Lloyd. "What's a navel, mother?" I asked, drowsy with warmth and a half loaf of bread. "She's like a special aunt. She's the one that cuts the cord when you're born and helps your mother get up out of bed when she's ready. They count that as your birthday, the day your mother gets up." "Not the day you were born?"
"Not the day you came out. They count the mother getting better as all part of the birth."
"Hallie doesn't have a birthday then," I said.
"After she was born, our mother never got up. She got real sick, and then a helicopter tried to come get her, and she died, all without ever putting her slippers on."
"Then Hallie never finished getting born," Lloyd said. He kissed the top of my head.
I was aware of the sleeping sounds of Inez and Hester on the other side of the makeshift curtain. I asked, "Is it okay that we're sleeping together?" Lloyd quietly laughed at me.
"It's okay with me. Is it okay with you?"
"I mean with your family."
"They're not hung up about it. Mama wanted to know if you're my woman."
"Meaning what?"
"As opposed to woman of the week, I guess."
"Woman of the year," I said. In the morning, snow had fallen, as deep as 5 or 6 quilts. The windows were round blue tunnels to the light, like the mouths of caves. Lloyd got up and went outside, where at dawn Inez and Bertie were already involved with the day's industry. He was sent back to bed with a whole fresh loaf of bread. "How did your dad meet her?" I asked. Lloyd and I were sitting on the roof of Inez's house now, facing south, waiting for ceremonies to begin in the plaza.
"At a dance over in Laguna, in the summertime. It was a corn dance. Everybody says she was a knockout when she was young. A real good dancer."
"I think she's a knockout now."
"He grew up over at Jicarilla."
"Where's that?"
"Not too far from here. It's another Apache reservation. Everybody goes to everybody's dances. We used to go over to the Navajo powwows in the fall."
Today,
On Christmas Day in Santa Rosalia, there were supposed to be dances from morning till night. Half the town seemed to be preparing to dance, while the other half were busy getting good seats. I had no idea what to expect. Anxious-looking little boys clutching feather crowns and fox pelts ran across the corners of the plaza bent low, as if this would make them invisible. Earlier in the day, these same little boys had run in boisterous gangs from house to house, banging on doors and begging for warm crusts torn from the morning loaves. A wholesome version of trick-or-treat. Give these kids one Halloween in grace, I thought, and they'd never be content with complex carbohydrates. So he married your mother, I said, and came here. The women are kind of the center of things up here. The man goes to the wife's place. But he didn't stay. I never really knew Dad that well. He was already gone when he was still here, if you know what I mean. I don't know what it was that hurt him. I know he grew up out of boarding school and never had much family, and he couldn't keep to the old ways. Or didn't know them. I don't know. It was real hard for him here. I let the subject go. As the twig is bent, so grows the tree, Doc Homer used to say, referring mostly to the bone structure of the feet, but it applied to moral life as well. And who knew how the kinks happened? They just did. I ought to know, as Hallie had bluntly pointed out in her letter. I'd marked myself early on as a bad risk, undeserving of love and incapable of benevolence. It wasn't because of a bad grade on a report card, as she'd supposed. It ran deeper than that. I'd lost what there was to lose. First my mother, and then my baby. Nothing you love will stay. Hallie could call that attitude a crutch, but she didn't know. She hadn't loved and lost so deeply. As Lloyd said, she'd never been born. Not into life as I knew it. Hallie could still risk everything. Lloyd and I dangled our feet over the side of the roof, looking out over the plaza and beyond to where the plaza ended suddenly, perforce, by the drop of a sheer cliff. I could only see this precipice as a threat and wonder how toddlers live to the age of reason without toddling over it, but many little feather-bedecked children were running along its edge as if it were nothing more than the end of a yard. I heard a drum and a brief burst of what sounded like sleigh bells. Then nothing. If anything ever did happen, we'd have a good view. We'd climbed a ladder to get where we were. Jack had given a long, dejected look up the rungs, as if he might consider the climb, if he weren't so dignified. Now he lay curled at the bottom, keeping watch. Old wooden ladders and aluminum extension ladders were propped everywhere. Second and third story roofs served as patios. All around the plaza, legs hung like fringe over the sides of buildings. I spotted Inez and some other relatives across the way. Inez's owlish glasses were the type that turned dark outdoors. Two huge black discs hid her round face as she sat, hands folded, inscrutable as a lifeguard. Not far from us, in a sheltered corner of the roof, was a wire pen full of geese and turkeys muttering the subdued prayers of the doomed. "Does your mama know you were a cockfighter?" I asked Lloyd. "No," he hesitated. "She knew Dad did it, and that he took Leander and me to the fights when we were little, but she didn't care for him doing that. She never knew I went on with it, and you better not tell her." "I'm gonna tell," I said, poking him in the ribs. "I'm gonna look up in my Kara's English dictionary, your son is a dirty low-down rooster fighter." Lloyd looked pained. Pleasing his mother was nothing to joke about. He'd given up cockfighting for Inez, not for me, I now understood. I'd just been the cricket in his ear. But that wasn't insignificant, I decided. I could settle for that. I looked down at the plaza whose quilt of fresh snow remained a virginal white, unmarred by tracks. This seemed miraculous considering the huge number of people crowded around its edges, a good 200 or more. People must have come from outside the pueblo. Jicarilla Apaches looking for knockout wives. "How come those houses over there near the edge of the cliff are falling down?" I asked. Their adobe plaster had cracked off, revealing the same artful masonry as Kanishpa in a state of collapse.
"Because they're old," Lloyd said. "Thank you. I mean, why doesn't somebody fix them up? You guys are the experts. You've been building houses for 900 years.
"Not necessarily in the same place.
This village was in 7 other places before they built it up here."
"So when something gets old, they just let it fall down?"
"Sometimes. Someday you'll get old and fall down."
"Thanks for reminding me." I shaded my eyes, looking to the east. Something was happening near the kiva, which was a building with a ladder poking out through a hatch in its roof. Lloyd had suggested I shouldn't show too much interest in it.
"The greatest honor you can give a house is to let it fall back down to the ground," he said. "That's where everything comes from in the first place."
I looked at him, surprised. "But then you've lost your house."
"Not if you know how to build another one. All those great pueblos, like at Kanishpa, people lived in them a while, and then they'd move on. Just leave them standing. Maybe go to a place with better water or something."
I thought they were homebodies. Lloyd rubbed his hand thoughtfully over my palm. Finally, he said, "The important thing isn't the house. It's the ability to make it. You carry that in your brain and in your hands wherever you go. Anglos are like turtles. If they go someplace, they have to carry the whole house along in their damn Winnesotas." I smiled. "Winnebagos. They're named after an Indian tribe."
It occurred to me, too late, that Lloyd already knew both these things. For months, I think, I'd been missing his jokes. Empress of the universe, instructing the heathen. "We're like coyotes," he said. "Get to a good place, turn around 3 times in the grass, and you're home. Once you know how, you can always do that, no matter what. You won't forget."
I thought of Inez's copious knickknacks and suspected Lloyd was idealizing a bit. But I liked the ideal. The thought of Hallie's last letter still stung me, but I tried to think abstractly about what she wanted to tell me. About keeping on the road because you know how to drive. That morality is not a large constructed thing you have or have not, but simply a capacity. Something you carry with you in your brain and in your hands. I'd come on this trip knowing I still had to leave Lloyd in June, that Grace wouldn't keep me, but maybe I was just keeping to the road. I felt guilt slip out of me like a stone. "It's a nice thought," I told him. "I guess I'll probably carry something away with me when I leave Grace." He looked at me carefully, started to speak, and then stopped. And then did speak. "It's one thing to carry your life wherever you go. Another thing to always go looking for it somewhere else." I didn't respond to that. I blinked hard and tried to look unconcerned, but the guilt nudged back along with the sharp glass edge of my own rationalization, recognized for what it was. I wasn't keeping to any road. I was running. Forgetting what lay behind and always looking ahead for the perfect home, where trains never wrecked and hearts never broke, where no one you loved ever died. Lloyd was a trap I could still walk out of. I listened to the sad geese in their pen and realized the crowd was quiet. The snowy plaza was marked with a single line of tracks. In the center of the white square stood a tall young woman in a black dress that hung from one shoulder. Her other shoulder was bare. Her waist, her upper arms and wrists, and her buckskin moccasins were all decorated with garlands of colored yarn, fur, and sleigh bells. At the crest of her head was a tuft of white eagle down. The sun shone purposefully on her hair. It was cut like Inez's, but hung loose to her waist, swaying as she moved slightly from one leg to the other, her feet barely leaving the ground. She looked graceful and cold. The sound of drums and then the drummers themselves emerged from the kiva. The 4 old men took their position at the edge of the plaza and propped their huge drums on their knees without missing a beat. They began a soft chant. A second line of men with blankets draped over their shoulders climbed down from the kiva, also singing, and took their places behind the old drummers. Then deer arrived, from everywhere. They were men and boys with black shirts and leggings, white kilts, and deer antlers. Their human features disappeared behind a horizontal band of black paint across the eyes. They moved like deer. They held long sticks in front of them, imitating the deer's cautious, long-legged grace, and they moved their heads anxiously to the side, listening, sniffing the wind. The woman in black stepped forward, shaking her gourd rattle, and they followed her. They became deer. They looked exactly as deer would look if you surprised them in a secret rite in the forest, moving in unison, following the irresistible hiss of a maiden's gourd rattle. I was entranced. More people climbed down out of the kiva. Some were dressed and armed as bow hunters who stalked the deer with patience. One man, who didn't seem to have any realistic function in the drama, was nearly naked and bizarrely painted. His body was ringed with black and white horizontal stripes. He had black rings painted around his eyes and mouth, and his hair was pulled up into a pair of corn tassel horns. He bounced around like a hysteric, possibly in the interest of keeping warm. "Who's the striped guy?" I asked Lloyd. "Koshari," he said. "A kachina. He has to do with fertility. His home's in the east." This struck me as humorous. "The east, as in New York? Area code 212? "The east, as in where the sun rises." "That's all part of his job description?" "All the kachinas have whole histories and families and live in one of the important places." "I thought a kachina was a little doll."
"That's right."
"And also a person dressed up?"
"Yep, and a spirit."
"A spirit with a family and a mailing address."
"That's right. When the person dresses up a certain way, the spirit comes into him, and into the doll, if it's made right."
"Okay," I said.
"What?"
"Nothing, just okay, I understand." He smiled at me sideways.
"You think it sounds voodoo?"
"All right, I'm narrow-minded. It sounds kind of voodoo." We both paid attention to the dancers for a while. I needed to keep a little distance from Lloyd.
"Anglos put little dolls of Santa Claus around their house at Christmas," Lloyd said without looking at me.
"Yeah, but it's just a little doll."
"And does it have a wife?"
"Yes," I conceded. "A wife and elves, and they live at the North Pole.
And sometimes one guy will dress up like Santa Claus and everybody acts a certain way when he comes around, all happy and generous."
I'd never been put in a position to defend Santa Claus. I'd never even believed in Santa Claus. I said,
"That's just because he stands for the spirit of Christmas."
"Exactly." Lloyd seemed very pleased with himself. One of the hunters had drawn his bow and shot an invisible arrow into a deer. It gave an anguished shiver, and then the other hunters lifted its limp carcass onto their shoulders.
"I've seen Jesus kachinas, too," Lloyd said. "I've seen them hanging all over people's houses in grace."
Now, there was a thought to ponder.
Koshari must also have been the spirit of nuisance or a good belly laugh. The other deer dancers still followed the maiden, ignoring the hunters and their own fallen brother. But Koshari clowned and cut between them, getting in their way and generally interfering with their solemnity. But when one of the youngest dancers lost his antlers, Koshari picked up the headdress and carefully reattached it by its buckskin laces. The boy kept dancing, eyes front, paying no attention to the hobgoblin who was putting his costume back together. At some later point, I noticed, Koshari had acquired a new-looking straw cowboy hat, which he cocked ridiculously on one of his horns. I had a feeling it wasn't the Navajo he was aping here. He walked duck-footed with a John Wayne swagger and was using a length of 2x4 as a gun. He knelt and fired repeatedly at the dancing deer, grandly falling over backward each time.
Later he stalked them, trailing his gun in the snow and tripping over it with admirably practiced body comedy. The deer eventually retreated to the cliff, and the plaza filled with two lines of new dancers, a row of black-clad women and a row of men in white kilts whose bodies beat a loud rhythm as they walked. Their chests were crisscrossed with lines of seashell bells. The two rows of dancers faced one another and stamped their feet, shaking the bells, crowding the air above the plaza with a loud, hollow clicking like summer insects. The men wore crowns of eagle feathers, and the women wore spectacular wooden headdresses painted with stylized clouds and slanting blue lines of rain and green blades of corn. This was the corn dance, officially a summer prayer, but danced at every important occasion, Lloyd said, because you couldn't pray it often enough. Most of the dances have to do with rain, he said. Here, that's what everything hangs on. Santa Claus kachinas and the beauty of the spectacle notwithstanding, I still felt outside of it. So, I said, you make this deal with the gods. You do these dances and they'll send rain and good crops and the whole works, and nothing bad will ever happen, right? Prayer had always struck me as more or less a glorified attempt at a business transaction. A rain dance, even more so. I thought I might finally have offended Lloyd past the point of no return, like stealing the lobster from frozen foods that time to get myself fired. But Lloyd was just thinking. After a minute, he said, no, it's not like that. It's not making a deal. Bad things can still happen, but you want to try not to cause them to happen. It has to do with keeping things in balance. In balance? Really, it's like the spirits have made a deal with us. And what is the deal? I asked. We're on our own. The spirits have been good enough to let us live here and use the utilities, and we're saying, we know how nice you're being. We appreciate the rain. We appreciate the sun. We appreciate the deer we took. Sorry if we messed up anything. You've gone to a lot of trouble, and we'll try to be good guests. Like a note you'd send somebody after you stayed in their house? Exactly like that. Thanks for letting me sleep on your couch. I took some beer out of the refrigerator, and I broke a coffee cup. Sorry. I hope it wasn't your favorite one. I laughed, because I understood in balance. I would have called it keeping the peace, or maybe remembering your place, but I liked it. It's a good idea, I said, especially since we're still here sleeping on God's couch. We're permanent house guests. Yep, we are. Better remember how to put everything back how we found it. It was a new angle on religion for me. I felt a little embarrassed for my blunt interrogation, and the more I thought about it, even more embarrassed for my bluntly utilitarian culture. The way they tell it to us Anglos, I said, God put the earth here for us to use, westward ho, like a special little playground. Lloyd said, well, that explains a lot. It explained a hell of a lot. I said quietly, because the dancers' bells were quieting down, but where do you go when you've pissed in every corner of your playground? I looked down at Koshari, who had ditched his cowboy hat and gun and seemed to be negotiating with Jack. I remembered Lloyd one time saying he'd die for the land, and I'd thought he meant patriotism. I'd had no idea. I wondered what he saw when he looked at the Black Mountain mine, the pile of dead tailings, a mountain cannibalizing its own guts and soon to destroy the living trees and home lives of Grace. It was such an American story. It was hardly even interesting. After showing me his secret hot springs, Lloyd had told me the Hemis Mountains were being mined savagely for pumice, the odd styrofoam-like gravel I'd thrown into the air in handfuls. Pumice was required for the manufacture of so-called distressed denim jeans. To people who think of themselves as God's house guests, American enterprise must seem arrogant beyond belief, or stupid. A nation of amnesiacs proceeding as if there were no other day but today, assuming the land could also forget what had been done to it. Our Koshari friend had somehow bought off Jack and taken away the ladder that was Lloyd's and my only way down. He was standing down there clowning now, pantomiming a smooching couple and talking at great length, playing to the crowd, which was laughing. At one point, they all applauded. Lloyd was plainly embarrassed. "What's he saying?" I asked. "I'll tell you in a minute." When Koshari had gone to another part of the plaza and people had stopped staring, I pressed Lloyd again. He said, "Now we'll have to stay up here together a long time." "He talked for 5 minutes, Lloyd. I know he said more than that."
"Yeah, he said by the time the snow melts, we'll..." Basically, he said in the spring there'd have to be a wedding.
I made a face. "And people liked that idea of you marrying me? They were clapping."
"You're not..."
He stopped, because a kind man in the crowd had come over to replace our ladder.
"You're not the ugly duck, you know," Lloyd said, once the man had gone.
"They don't even know me. I'm an outsider."
"I'm an outsider, too," he said. "They probably know my mother likes you."
"How would they know that?"
"Word gets around."
"I mean, how does she know that? I can't even talk to her."
"Do you like her?"
"Yeah, I do."
"How do you know?"
"I like her hugs. She makes good bread."
"Well, maybe that's why she likes you. You like her bread."
It was hard to stay mad at Lloyd. The corn dancers had remarkable stamina. Sometimes they danced in two facing lines, their whole axis rotating around the plaza like a wheel. At other times, the women's line moved into and through the men's, and they broke into pairs, the men leading, practically prancing, while the women held their eyes on the ground with such concentration as to render it fertile. I would have believed a thunderclap just then and a summer rainstorm. They danced on and on. The women's moccasined feet and thickly wrapped legs moved only a fraction of an inch with each step, but the restrained action of that step must have cost more effort than jumping jacks. They did it and did it and did it until early afternoon. The corn dance was followed by an eagle dance, which seemed to involve all the young children in the village and a few older, more skillful dancers. Each one was dressed in a dark shirt and leggings, a white embroidered kilt, and a hood of white eagle down, complete with eyes and a hooked beak. Running from fingertip to fingertip across their backs, they had eagle feather wings. The youngsters trembled with concentration as they crouched low, then rose in unison, raising their wings and soaring in convincing eagle-like fashion. It seemed slightly less reverent than the previous dances, more akin to the childhood phenomenon of the dance recital. But Lloyd said this was also a prayer. Every dance is a prayer. The eagle carries people's thoughts to the spirits in the sky, animal messengers for the small human hope. As they danced, the children's lips moved constantly in silent recitation. "Watch," Lloyd said. "One will go toward the east." One did. It was one of the older, more reliable dancers. He glided with outstretched wings to the edge of the plaza and past it, down the central street toward the eastern end of the village. Lloyd explained that he was carrying the mother's concerns for all the boys in the armed service. Koshari was now solemnly busy among the children who needed a good deal of prompting and putting together of costume parts. At several points, he left the dancers and made his way around the crowd, taking requests for special blessings, special worries. I asked Lloyd to get his attention. "For my sister," I said, and Lloyd translated. "She's in the south, a long way to the south." Near the end of the dance, one small eagle arched his wings and ran all the way to the southern end of the plaza. The wind lifted his feathers as he paused on the edge of the precipice, and for just a second I was sure he would have to fall or fly. Homero. Chapter 20. The Scream. The kettle is about to boil,
and the telephone rings. He dries his hands slowly and goes to answer it, expecting Mandy Navarrete's fourth child. Christmas Day, a long, silent day, will end now with a long, unpleasant night. There was a time when deliveries excited him. During the gene pool study, he looked forward to those infant eyes and setting up his camera and lights. But there is nothing to study now. Mandy Navarrete is all muscles and resistance, a woman who delivers in her own time. Her grandmother, Concepcion Navarrete, was his first grade teacher. She was similarly muscular and disapproved of his family. He lifts the receiver slowly on the fourth or fifth ring. The voice speaks in hurried Spanish, but he answers in English because he knows they can understand. He hasn't spoken Spanish since the day he married Alice. "There is plenty of time," he says. "I know this process. We don't need to be in a panic." He hears silence, static, several different voices and questions, and then the same voice again, emphatically repeating its word. Secuestrada. Kidnapped. "Who is this?" He listens. The voice is very distant and often breaks. It is a woman, a friend of his daughter. He tries to understand which daughter they mean. Secuestrada. Cody has been away for several days, but this voice is saying Holly. Someone is keeping her. She was in the field alone with her horse when they came to blow up the building where she has chemicals for the crop. He understands none of this and lets it sift past him like pollen, like his life. There are many more words in his life than he would like most of the time. Holly! The woman insists, as if she is trying to wake him from sleep. "Are you the father? El padre de Holly Nolina? We are very much afraid." We are very much afraid. In the first grade, she hit a boy and they kept her after school. The boy's name was Simon Bolivar Jones. He was angry at her and had called her vicious names because she climbed to the top of the tall slide the wrong way, up the slide and not the steps, and stood up there and danced, shouting, her hands outstretched. No boy could do it. "You should let her come home. She hasn't done anything wrong. She's being punished for an act of bravery." He isn't sure whether he has just spoken in Spanish or English. "Sí," the voice answers after a moment. "Claro que sí." "Where is she?" "No estamos seguros. We think they must have taken her into Honduras, where they're camped. A large patrol has gone to look for her. 30 people, more than half of them from the village where she lives. There were more who wanted to go, even an 8-year-old boy. Holly has many friends." Even an 8-year-old boy. 30 people. The words are so much fine dust, suspended in the air before him, in the long trapezoidal block of sunlight from the window. He examines the dust. He sees the word Holly. It was Cody who stood up and danced on the slide. "You should let her come home," he says again. He can remember precisely the muscular line of Mrs. Navarrete's disapproving jaw. "Let my daughter come home now." The voice rejects this statement, says nothing. He touches the corner of his eye and is surprised to find moisture on his fingertips. He stares at an iron coal bucket beside the fireplace, trying to recall its history, how it came to him. He thinks, for no reason, that this iron coal bucket could save his life, if only he could remember. He remembers instead that he no longer delivers babies. The telephone call could not possibly be Mandy Navarrete. It is a woman from another country who knows his daughter. He is trying hard not to look at the dust in the air, but the sun has illuminated each particle so that it glows. Each word burns. "Is there something I can do?" he asks finally.
I know she has friends in the Ministry of Agriculture. Do they know?
Everyone knows. Our Ministry of Agriculture, your Ministry of Agriculture. There is a pause. You understand that this occurs every day. We are a nation of bereaved families. The only difference this time is that it happens to be an American. It happens to be Hallie. The voice weakens again and he waits and it goes on. We sent a telegram to your president and the NBC. We think if they are embarrassed enough by their contras, they could do something. If they are embarrassed enough.
Wait. Let me take down the number where you are, so I can call you tomorrow.
I'm in the office of a church in Managua. Nobody here knows anything. You can call the Ministry of Agriculture if you want, or your president. He is the responsible party. He understands that she is being as helpful as she can. She is a kind, tired voice. He doesn't want her to hang up, because then his life will begin. There is a pause while she talks to someone else who is there with her, and then she returns to him and says, I'm sorry.
Is there anything more besides waiting?
I'm sorry. There is nothing. Carefully, he puts down the receiver and looks at the air in front of the window in this empty room, the dust. He listens inside himself for a long time before he understands that it's the tea kettle that is screaming. Cosima. Chapter 21. The Tissue of Hearts. Hallie was somebody's prisoner. Whether my eyes were open or closed, I saw her with a white cloth tied tightly over her mouth. That's the only image that would ever come. If she couldn't scream, I did. I was in every way unreasonable, especially with the kids at school. Even at the time, I was lucid enough to be thankful that Rita had dropped out. One member of my family had already yelled at her. She didn't have to know that neither one of us had all our tires on the road. The students had tried to be cooperative. They went to Tucson to assist the Stitch and Bitch Club, as I'd requested, and found the city to be a superb adventure. They discovered a video arcade. Ramo sweet-talked more than 10 young women into buying piñatas. There were rumors that Connie Munoz gave Hector Jones a hand job in the backseat of the bus on the way home. What did I expect? They were teenagers. I knew that, but still I screamed at them because Black Mountain was poisoning their mother's milk and all they cared about was sex and a passing grade. I had rational intentions. I talked about evapotranspiration and rainforests and oxygen in the biosphere, how everything was connected, the last virgin timber cleared and milled to make way for a continent of landfills choking on old newspapers. It was a poetic lecture. Marta made the mistake of asking me how much of this poetry was going to be on the test. I glowered. Your life is the test. If you flunk this one, you die. The whole front row looked stunned. Their pens stopped moving. What you people learn for a test, you forget the next day. That's bullshit. That's a waste of your brains and my time. If I can't teach you something you'll remember, then I haven't even been here this year. I crossed my arms and glared at them. You kids think this pollution shit is not your problem, right? Somebody will clean up the mess. It's not your fault. Well, your attitude stinks. You're as guilty as anybody. Do you or do you not think the world was put here for you to use? Nobody was fool enough to answer. I observed during the long silence that half the kids in the room were wearing stonewashed jeans. I yanked up Hector Jones by the arm and made an example of him. I have to admit, I disliked Hector partially for unfair reasons. His father was a former hoodlum named Simon Bolivar Jones, who'd been noticeably unkind to me in school. Stand up here, I said. Show everybody your jeans. Nice, right? Turn around. Nice ass, Hector. Wonderful jeans. They were half worn out before you bought them, right? I smacked Hector lightly on the butt and let him sit down.
You know how they make those? They wash them in a big machine with the special kind of gravel they get out of volcanic mountains. The prettiest mountains you ever saw in your life, but they're fragile, like a big pile of sugar. Levi Strauss or whoever goes in there with bulldozers and chainsaws and cuts down the trees and rips the mountainsides to hell so that all us lucky Americans can wear jeans that look like somebody threw them in the garbage before we got them.
Trees grow back, Ramo said. Ramo was a brave young man.
Excuse me?
He cupped his hands around his mouth and spoke as if I were his deaf grandmother. Trees grow back.
I cupped my hands around my mouth and said just as loudly, not if the whole damn mountain is gone, they don't.
Well, there's other mountains.
Sure, there's some other mountains, I said, feeling that I might explode if I weren't careful. If you got hit by a truck, Ramo, I guess your ma would say, well, I have some other kids.
About half the class thought that was funny. The other half was probably trying to figure out how to get out of my classroom alive. I stared them down, ticking like a bomb.
Sure, trees grow back. Even a whole rainforest could grow back in a couple hundred years, maybe, but who's going to make it happen? If you had to pay the real price for those jeans, the cost and the time and the work of bringing that mountain back to life instead of leaving it dead, those pretty jeans would have cost you $100.
I felt strangely high, furious and articulate.
Think about the gas you put in a car, I said. The real cost. Not just pumping it out of the ground and refining it and shipping it, but also cleaning up the oil spills and all the junk that goes into the air when it gets burned. That's part of what it costs. But you're not paying it. Gas ought to be $20 a gallon, so you're getting a real good deal. But soon the bill comes due and we pay it. Or we eat dirt. The ultimate master charge.
I can't swear they were listening, but they were watching me carefully. 36 blue eyes ticked back and forth as I paced the floor in front of my desk.
If Grace gets poisoned, if all these trees die and this land goes to hell, you just go somewhere else, right? Like the great pioneers, Lewis and Clark. Well, guess what, kiddos? The wilderness is used up.
I walked around my little square of floor like a trapped cat.
People can forget and forget and forget, but the land has a memory. The lakes and the rivers are still hanging on to the DDT and every other insult we ever gave them. Lake Superior is a superior cesspool. The fish have cancer. The ocean is getting used up. The damn air is getting used up. I pointed at the ceiling, meaning to indicate the sky. You know what's up there? Ozone. It's this stuff in the atmosphere that acts like an umbrella.
I stopped and reconsidered this effete analogy. Teenagers who won't use condoms aren't impressed by the need for an umbrella.
I surveyed the class thoughtfully and demanded, whose dad or mom ever worked in the smelter?
About half the hands went up, reluctantly.
You know what they did up there, right? One way or another, they were around 1,000-degree hot metal. You ever see them dressed for work? They wore coveralls like Mr. Neil Armstrong walking on the moon and a big shield over their faces, right?
They nodded, relieved, I suppose, that I wasn't going to single them out for humiliation.
I sat on the desk and crossed my arms.
Imagine that's you, working up there with that hot metal in your face.
Now somebody rips that mask off you while you're working. Goodbye, face. Goodbye, nose and eyelids, beauty queens. You're dead.
They might as well have been dead for all the sound they made.
That's what the ozone layer does for us, boys and girls. It's a big face shield in the sky.
I was skipping a few steps here, but not really exaggerating the consequences. Not at all. I attempted to lower my voice and sound faintly reasonable.
And it's slipping away from us. There's a big hole in it over the South Pole. When you use a spray can, you make that hole bigger.
There's something in most aerosol cans and refrigerators and air conditioners called chlorofluorocarbons that neutralizes the ozone. Factories are still making tons of it right now. I suspect chlorofluorocarbons was the largest word ever spoken within the walls of Grace High, and I'm fairly sure also that nobody forgot it for at least the rest of the day.
After the bell rang, Connie Munoz eyed me and said, "Miss, I seen you wear stonewashed jeans to school sometimes." The other kids were already out of there like bats out of hell. "You're right," I said. "I didn't know about the mountains when I bought them, just like Hector didn't and you didn't." "Yeah?" She chewed her gum and held me under a neutral, military sort of gaze. I'd publicly humiliated her new boyfriend. This would require some diplomacy. "I've been learning a lot of this stuff just lately," I told her. "I'm not saying I'm not part of the problem."
"So how come you're so mad at us, miss?"
I felt conscious of my height and embarrassed. "Connie, I don't really know, because I'm guilty too, I guess, and now I'm trying to fix it all at once." A hint of life came into her eyes.
"Don't sweat it," she said. "I think it's cool that you cuss and stuff when you're mad. Everybody was paying attention. What you said was right. These guys just think when they use something up, there's always going to be more."
"I shouldn't have cussed," I said. "I'm supposed to be setting an example, and I shouldn't have picked on Hector the way I did." She laughed and cracked her gum. "Hector Jones is a dickhead." I had dinner at Doc Homer's house. I had done so every night since I got back from Santa Rosalia and found out Hallie had been kidnapped. If I badgered him enough, I kept thinking, he would have something more to tell me. But he couldn't remember anything. If I'd ever doubted Hallie was his favorite, there was no question about it now. I'd never seen him so affected by any event in our lives. He still functioned, cooked for himself, and went to work, but it was only an obstinate ritual. He was a mess. I'd found some of his medication bottles in a cache in the living room inside an old iron coal bucket. There was no way to know whether he was taking them. Half the time he talked to me as if I were 6 years old.
"Who was the person you spoke with on the phone?" I asked again. "Was she somebody in the government? There's got to be somebody we can call."
I cautiously eyed the plate he set down in front of me. Doc Homer had prepared liver with steamed apples and yellow squash. In certain restaurants, things like this passed for haute cuisine, I knew, but here it passed for weird. It was getting to where he'd combine anything he found in his refrigerator. I'd started shopping for him, lest he get down to refried beans and ice cream. "She suggested that we call the President of the United States," he said. I set my fork down on the table. He'd said this quite a number of times before. "I think I will call the President." I moved my chair back from the table. It was an idle threat. I'd probably just get a polite recording. But I knew Doc Homer wouldn't want what he would consider an absurd long-distance call on his bill. "I understand you have a boyfriend," he said, cutting his liver and apples into small pieces. "What do they think will happen? Did this person you talked to sound real worried? Or did she say this was a routine kind of thing? Sometimes they'll just take a foreign hostage to get attention and then they'll let them go the next day. She's probably back at her house already." I knew this was unlikely. The Contras, as I understood it, didn't need attention. They were fully supported by the richest sugar daddy in the modern world. "He drinks, Cody. He will take advantage of you." I stared at Doc Homer for a long time. "Not anymore," I said. "He doesn't drink anymore. And he couldn't take advantage of me if he wanted to. I'm as sweet and innocent as the Berlin Wall. Your concern is approximately 2 decades too late." "My concern is for your welfare."
"Your concern?"
I picked up slices of apple and ate them with my fingers to annoy him. "I'm going to have to go down there. I can get a bus to Tucson tonight and a plane to Managua and be there tomorrow." I doubted it was this easy. The tea kettle boiled and he jumped up. He seemed edgy. He got out the filter paper and slowly set up the drip machine for coffee, carefully positioning each part of the apparatus as if it were some important experiment in organic chemistry. "I told you it wasn't a good idea," he said, pouring boiling water into the funnel. I waited for some further clue. He could be evaluating any mistake I'd made since age 3.
What idea is that? I prompted, since he didn't go on.
Lloyd Peregrina.
We both watched the water pass through the dark grounds, absorbing their color and substance. He'd never mentioned Lloyd's name before. I was surprised he knew it. I wondered whether Doc Comer had a whole other life in his head, in which he dispensed kind, fatherly advice. This gulf between what Doc Comer believed himself to be and what he was brought out the worst in me, or the most blunt.
Don't worry about Lloyd Peregrina, I said. I can't get hurt now. I'm leaving him this time. It's just a short-term thing.
He won't elevate your life.
Damn it, you don't know the first thing about my life. What's to elevate? I'm a medical school dropout who works graveyard shifts in quick marts.
You left the profession by choice. We've established that.
Okay, so I walked out the door with my eyes open. What did I choose instead? What am I good at? Name one thing.
He balked. I knew he would. Doc Comer wasn't fluent in the language of compliments. I have no career, no kids, not even a place I consider home. Basically, I'm a bag lady with an education. That's a preposterous assessment.
How would you know? You don't really see me. You just see what you want. You take pictures of people and turn them into rock walls.
That is not what I do.
I begin with a picture in my head from the past. I try to duplicate it from the images I have at hand.
This was a new one.
I don't believe I give a damn about the images you have at hand.
I lowered my voice. The quickest way to lose points with Doc Comer was to lose control.
I said, you always just wanted Hallie and me to be above everybody in grace.
You were above your peers.
I snorted at that. I was as trashy as Connie Munoz and Rita Cardinal, without half their guts or one-tenth of their sex appeal. I was ugly and embarrassed to be alive.
Doc Comer had a strange way of actually getting quieter when he raised his voice. My daughters were not trash, he said. I looked him square in the eye. I got pregnant when I was 15. I know. I watched you bury the baby in the riverbed. I felt an odd flush in my neck and face. For about a minute, we both listened to the dripping of the coffee pot. Then I said,
why do you lie about everything?
I've never told you anything but the truth.
You've never told me anything, period. You said you and Mother came from Illinois. But you came from here. You've got a whole family lying up there in the damn graveyard.
We did come here from Illinois. I was stationed there and went to medical school there. We moved back here after the war.
What kind of war had people stationed in Illinois? I asked absurdly, close to tears. I'm sorry, but in history class they never told us about the Midwestern Front.
Alice's family despised me.
I stopped, remembering how Viola had averted her eyes and said, that family went downhill, the day I discovered Homero Nolina up in the cemetery. The red-haired Gracela sister with the temper, who married Conrado Nolina and produced a legacy of trash, that was my father's family. What he believed he came from, and what we still were. Auburn-haired and angry, living in exile in our own town. There wasn't enough air in the kitchen for me to breathe and get all this in.
So you, what, ran off to the army? Got yourself educated on the GI Bill and then came back here as the mighty prodigal doctor with his beautiful new wife and acted like nobody could touch you?
I watched him closely but could read nothing. I couldn't even see him, really. I had no idea how he'd look to a stranger. Old, sick, mean-spirited. He poured coffee into two mugs and gave the larger one to me.
Thank you, I said.
You're welcome.
Why did you come back here?
If it was so important to you to start over, you could have gone anywhere. You could have stayed back there in Illinois.
Doc Homer sat down opposite me. He clenched and unclenched his left hand, then spread it flat on the table and examined it abstractly as if it were a patient. I looked at the framed photograph on the wall over his head, his portrait of a hand that wasn't a hand, but five cacti with invisible spines. He asked me suddenly, "Why do you suppose the poets talk about hearts when they discuss emotional damage? The tissue of hearts is tough as a shoe. Did you ever sew up a heart?" I shook my head. "No, but I've watched. I know what you mean. The walls of a heart are thick and strong, and the surgeons use heavy needles. It takes a good bit of strength, but it pulls together neatly. As much as anything, it's like binding a book." "The seat of human emotion should be the liver," Doc Homer said. "That would be an appropriate metaphor. We don't hold love in our hearts. We hold it in our livers."
"I understand exactly. Once in ER, I saw a woman who'd been stabbed everywhere, most severely in the liver. It's an organ with the consistency of layer upon layer of wet Kleenex. Every attempt at repair just opens new holes that tear and bleed. You try to close the wound with fresh wounds, and you try, and you try, and you don't give up until there's nothing left." For Christmas, Lloyd had given me an Apache burden basket. It was exquisitely woven, striped with the colors of dried grass, and around its open mouth hung tin bells on leather thongs that made whispery tinkling sounds. It wasn't much bigger than a teacup. The night he gave it to me in Santa Rosalia, I felt it would easily hold all my burdens, forever. Now it hung on the wall over my bed, and at night I looked at it and wept for my own stupidity in trusting that life could be kind. I apologized to my classes. I couldn't see trying to maintain the recommended authoritative distance. I told him my sister had been kidnapped and that I was scared to death. I told him everything seemed very serious to me now, including things like the ozone layer. The kids were extremely quiet. I don't think any adult had ever apologized to them before. From the storeroom, we got down a pre-World War II map that showed all the world's climatic zones, and we found Nicaragua, Honduras, Costa Rica, El Salvador. The shapes and names of many nations had changed during the lifetime of that map, but not the climatic zones. We talked more calmly about the rainforest and the manner in which fast food chains were cutting it down to make hamburger farms. We talked about poor countries and rich countries and DDT in the food chain and the various ways our garbage comes home to us. The memory of the land. My students understood these things perfectly well. There is nothing boring about the prospect of extinction. On Friday, I took the day off to make phone calls. Hallie had left me a list of emergency telephone numbers, mostly speculative, and I called them all. It took the whole morning. I got nowhere with the State Department and the U.S. Department of Agriculture and ended up with the Nicaraguan Ministry of Agriculture. Viola helped me contend with the impenetrable Spanish of international operators. Emelina sat on my other side holding my hand, wringing the fingers, apparently forgetting that it wasn't hers. Mason and the baby sat on the floor in front of us, silent, wondering, as children always must wonder in a crisis, what terrible thing they had done to wreck the world. We learned nothing useful. They were sure now that Hallie had been taken across the border into Honduras, probably to a camp where many other prisoners were held. It was a well-outfitted camp. They had Sony radios and high-quality sea rations. It made me smile a little to think Hallie might be eating sea rations I dutifully paid for with my taxes. Dinner was on me. So were the landmines.
I spoke with a dozen secretaries of this and that, and finally with the Minister of Agriculture himself. He knew Hallie.